Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we're going to delve into the results of last week's local elections. Voters were weighing in on some key issues, from who should serve as San Francisco's next mayor to whether the Oakland mayor and Alameda County District Attorney should be recalled. We'll look at the outcomes and discuss what they might mean for Bay Area residents. Then we're going to sit down with Ray Black of Oakland's For the Win Boxing, a boxing gym that offers professional coaching geared towards women and non-binary people who want to pursue the sweet science of boxing. But first, there was some exciting news out of the University of California, Berkeley recently about a potential new tool in the fight against climate change. So last week, I sat down with one of the scientists who made the discovery. Let's take a listen.
Carbon dioxide is the primary greenhouse gas responsible for global warming, and reducing those emissions has been a long-standing pillar of climate action. But even with reduced carbon dioxide, we'll still need to capture carbon from the air to undo the damage from historic emissions and offset ongoing emissions that are hard to abate. And now scientists at the University of California, Berkeley have come up with a new substance that has shown promise at doing just that. It's an exciting development with potentially significant implications. And so we're so pleased to be joined tonight by Omar Yaghi, professor of chemistry at UC Berkeley and senior author of a paper published recently in the journal Nature about the new substance. So welcome to State of the Bay, Omar.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by asking if you can just tell us about the substance that you developed. What is it called? What does it look like? And how does it work to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere?
Well, to the naked eye, it looks like baby powder or granulated sugar. This material we call Covalent Organics Framework Number 999, or for short, COF 999. It has a yellow color. But if you zoom in on just one granule, zoom in all the way down to the atomic level, the size of the CO2 molecule, you'll see that each granule is riddled with holes, billions of them. And in these holes is exactly where we can install molecular units that can seek out CO2 from air and bring it into the pore, concentrate it into the pores. And the exciting part here is that this material is durable. It can be cycled many cycles, and it plucks CO2 out of the air so that you have clean air.
So I guess it's almost like a little tiny sponge, but then how does it attract the carbon dioxide into this porous area that you just described?
Well, these pores, we can go in like surgeon and on the atomic level, modify them so that they are CO2 loving pores. So we've been doing this for water harvesting from air to make drinking water or other substances, cleaning water from organics. And now we have been able to modify the material so that it can trap CO2 from air. Now, a big development that we have been working on since the initial discovery of COFs back in 2005 is that we've been trying to make these structures almost like Lego pieces that we have been developing on connecting them together through some of the strongest bonds in chemistry to make the material overall durable in performing the CO2 capture from air.
And you say they can be reused, but I guess I think of it as a bit of a sponge. And with a sponge, you'd have to wring out the water. How do you reuse this substance if the pores are already filled with carbon?
You only need to heat it up to 50 degrees Celsius or 60 degrees Celsius, depending on the conditions. But at low temperature, by heating, you can remove the CO2.
And what happens to the CO2 once you remove it?
Well, right now, it's concentrated and then pumped under the ground for long-term storage. Until we have a better way of converting CO2 to important materials and substances, maybe even clean fuel, we'll just have to pump the CO2 that we capture under the ground.
And you described how you have to manipulate the atom to be able to get it to absorb CO2. How do you do that manipulation at the atomic level?
Well, that's really the essence of the chemistry that we've been developing over the last 30 years. We call it reticular chemistry. And reticular chemistry is all about precision of design of these sponges, as you call them, or these porous frameworks. But also, once you make them, you can also go in and modify them chemically by attaching units bonded to the interior of the structure so that it can capture CO2 from air selectively. And during the making of these materials and studying them, we uncovered many secrets of what CO2 is doing in the pore. And sometimes water comes in and it turns out that some water is actually beneficial and it increases the CO2 uptake capacity, as well as it helps in the speed with which CO2 goes in and comes out. So, you know, we've been trying to avoid water for 10 years. And then with this discovery, we realized that water is actually helpful to the CO2 uptake capacity.
And I know you've described this in an interview with the San Francisco Chronicle as a game changer technology for capturing carbon. Can you describe how this is different and why you think it's better than some of the other proposed methods and demonstrated methods for capturing carbon, such as using plant-based technology, nature-based solutions, or mechanical solutions that capture carbon directly from the air?
The amount of extra carbon in the air is huge. It's 1,100 gigatons of CO2 exist in the air that we need to take out. In order to take that amount of CO2 out of the air, we need materials that are going to work a cycle after cycle after cycle for years. And so the challenge has been, could materials be made durable enough so that they stay in a plant for many, many years, taking CO2 out and then evolving the CO2 as I described before. The cycling is extremely important. Not many materials have been cycled as much as this material has. And the other solutions are either very energy intensive because you're heating amine solutions, or they're just not viable for taking up so much CO2 from the atmosphere. If you look at the data we report in our paper, it shows very clearly that not only does it pluck the CO2 out of the air and concentrates it in its pores, but also it's durable enough. And in our report, we showed that it can carry out 100 cycles. But when you look at the results of those 100 cycles where the material is not degrading whatsoever, it means that the material can last for many, many years before it has to be regenerated.
So typical barriers to carbon capture technology involve cost, permitting, energy inputs, where to store the carbon dioxide. So I'd love to talk to you about each of those challenges and hear how this technology could stack up. So maybe let's start with cost. What are you anticipating as the cost to scale this up?
Well, I mean, in my lab, we're working on a gram scale. And obviously, the cost goes down as the scale goes up. That's one of the things that we have learned with materials. But also, the constituents of this material are not exotic. They're not strange constituents that require laborious methods of making. They're already being made, already being scaled up. We just succeeded in stitching them together in a way that made it beneficial for capturing CO2. So I don't think that either the scale-up or the cost is going to be prohibitive in any way.
So the material is ubiquitous that you would need?
The material is, there's plenty of the constituents around, and they're not new in themselves. And the process of making is simple.
So you don't need a lot of energy or other costs to actually make
nothing out of the ordinary. Okay, compared to other materials that are being widely used in society already. You mentioned the energetic cost. The traditional materials for CO2 capture, such as those amine solutions, you have to heat them up to 120 degrees Celsius to remove the CO2 after they had absorbed it from the air. Our material only has to be heated to 50 or 60 degrees Celsius. So already you're saving a lot of energy by heating a solid rather than a liquid.
And then let's say we got to a mass scale using this technology. How would you envision the deployment? Would there be facilities all around the world? Would they need access to electricity for that heating process? What would it look like on the landscape to have these scaled up?
We already have pilot plants that are testing in many different countries. So their sizes are no different than a size of a chemical plant. And the way the material would be deployed is that either you make it out of pallet-shaped, or you could make it as coating to allow maximum exposure of the granules to air and maximum uptake of CO2 into those pores.
But you'd also need a place then to store the carbon dioxide. So Would you need to be located over empty subterranean spaces?
Either that, or it could be shipped off in trucks to the proper location.
And what's the next step to scale this up? You mentioned you've already demonstrated this technology success on campus at UC Berkeley. What needs to happen now to scale this?
It's already in the hands of a startup in Irvine called Atoko. And Atoko is already scaling up this material, simplifying the synthesis even further and making sure that the components are made in a cheap, inexpensive way.
And how soon would you imagine that we might start seeing a profit-making or large-scale facility that's going, if not making a profit, at least taking in revenue and selling those credits?
Well, I would say that once this material scaled up to ton quantities, which I expect in the next 6 months to 1 year period, then we can put it in some of the pilots that have already been developed out there. So the time between scale up and testing is shortened because those installations are already in place.
And how has the scientific community responded to this? I mean, it seems like a big breakthrough, and I'm just curious what response you've gotten from your peers.
It's been amazing. I mean, my students have looked up the number of downloads of our paper, and the altmetrics, as it's called, the interest in the paper is off scale. I'm receiving hundreds of emails every day on various aspects of this discovery from academia, from industry, from venture capitalists, from all sectors of society. It's very, very exciting. Problems like the CO2 capture problem require technical solutions. Those solutions don't exist if you don't have the right material.
And what are some of the challenges, if any, that you would see now to see this deploy at a larger scale?
Well, I mean, I think in general, society has to decide that CO2 capture is a big problem. And certainly more of us believe that CO2 is a societal problem than ever before. So that's a good direction. But I think overall, we need to start thinking about the CO2 problem, not just as a problem, but as a crisis that requires a major effort on the part of all sectors of society to make it a reality. Now we have a material that works, and it looks quite durable. So we need to be able to do this swiftly, and that requires a lot of resources. Yeah.
And do you have any sense as to, or any projections, estimates at this point, what the cost per ton of carbon dioxide using this method might be to capture it versus some of the other technologies? Like, how much savings are we talking about?
It's hard to say. This is Atoko's information, but I can say is that it's a lot better than it is today. So I am very much excited about the prospect of deploying this material.
And you also mentioned the need for water. Now, in some parts of the world and this country, that's no big deal. But in California, of course, we're famous for our droughts and some very water-constrained parts of the state. Would that be a big hurdle to deployment in certain places? How much water are we talking about?
Not at all. Small amounts of water are sufficient, and that water is not destroyed in the process. Actually, it comes out with the CO2. So, in fact, in the past, we have developed materials that take up water out of the air to make drinking water. Potentially, these plants that are taking up CO2 could also be making water as well, clean water.
And what motivated you to explore in this area? You mentioned this material has been around for a long time. Was this deliberate that you were looking for a solution to capturing carbon, or was there an aha moment that you weren't expecting?
Well, I think the aha moment came when we were able to make these materials from some of the strongest bonds known in chemistry, like carbon-carbon bonds and carbon-carbon double bonds and carbon-nitrogen double bonds. These are extremely strong bonds, so we knew we'd be able to make durable materials. And the problem of CO2 capture, everybody knew that the materials were lacking. So these materials clearly showed durable performance, and it was natural for us to say, well, let's modify them so that they can take up CO2 from air. And it worked. And it was extremely exciting to see how Berkeley open air could be passed through the material, and all the CO2 in the air is being scrubbed by the material. That was the moment where I looked at my student who was doing the experiment. I said, I think you've just solved the world's most difficult problem.
Wow, it's really amazing to think about. So if all goes well, 5 years from now, 2030, What would you envision happening with deployment and the climate crisis?
Well, I think it depends on how intensely we stand behind solving the problem. I think the scientific problem of CO2 capture from air is solved. I think now we need to scale up the material. As I said, we will reach a ton quantities in 6 months to 1 year. And I think the rest is just the intensity with which society wants to solve the problem.
And for listeners who want to learn more about this material and the process, what do you recommend?
They can go directly to the paper that appeared in Nature or go to my website, yagi.berkeley.edu.
And Professor Yagi, anything I haven't asked you about that you want to mention?
No, I think that once society decides we have a problem, scientists can solve that problem. Okay, it just needs the intensity of society to say we have a crisis and we need a solution. And scientists always rise to the occasion.
Well, it's a perfect note to end this. Thank you so much, Omar Yagi, professor of chemistry at UC Berkeley and one of the scientists who developed COF999. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Omar.
It's my pleasure.
Hi, I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. On Tuesday, November 19th, join us for a live recording of Philosophy Talk on the Stanford campus.
We'll be thinking about Mayan philosophy with Edgar Garcia, author of Emergency, reading the Popol Vuh in a time of crisis.
This event is free and open to the public. Everybody welcome. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Tuesday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Stanford Humanities Center.
Mull over Mayan mythology with us.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at kalw.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Many in the Bay Area spent the days after last week's election processing the results of the presidential race. With the stakes so high at that level, the national election can certainly suck all the air out of the room. But at the same time, Bay Area voters were weighing in on some really important state and local issues in the election. San Francisco was choosing a new mayor, and Oakland residents were considering whether to recall their mayor and the Alameda County District Attorney, and there were ballot measures that addressed crime, housing, governance, and more. So how did all these local measures fare, and what do the results tell us about the concerns and priorities of Bay Area residents? To help us answer those questions and more, I'm pleased to welcome back Emily Hoven, who's an opinion columnist and editorial writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me, Ethan.
It's great to have you back on. And we also want you, our listener, to be a part of this next conversation. What races or ballot measures were most important to you when you voted? And how are you feeling about the results? You can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Emily, let me start with the biggest local race this election cycle. That's the San Francisco mayor's race. And we know that Daniel Lurie came out on top after pouring $8.6 million of his own money into his campaign. But what factors do you think played into his victory over the incumbent mayor, London Breed?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that money played some role. Daniel Lurie was relatively unknown to most residents of San Francisco before this campaign, before, you know, he was able to pour all of this money into ads and countless flyers and mailers. There was also an independent expenditure committee, largely funded by his mother, that continued to get his face in front of voters and his name in front of voters. But, you know, I also want to emphasize that money is not everything. You know, there was a lot of money flowing in this race, a lot of billionaires backing actually all of the candidates in this race. And I think what it really came down to was the way in which that money was used and the messages that each candidate sent to voters. And I think it was really clear, not only in the Bay Area, but also across the country this cycle, that voters were not too pleased with the incumbents and were really going for folks that promised a change from the status quo. And, you know, Daniel Lurie had never held political office before. He was really coming in as an outsider to clean up the mess from the City Hall insiders. That was kind of the slogan that he used. And clearly it resonated with a lot of people here.
And Emily, do you think there were any big particular issues? You talk about this sort of, you know, anti-incumbency feeling here. Were there any big issues that you think really stood out as decisive when it came to the San Francisco mayor election?
I think the number one issue was sort of public safety. And that is something that all of the candidates emphasized. And many of them took, you know, pretty tough on crime stances. But I think voters have made very clear that they don't feel safe on the streets of San Francisco. They are tired with seeing open air drug markets and, you know, homelessness that doesn't seem to be getting any better, despite the billions of dollars that the city has been addressing the issue with. And they're tired of having their items locked up at Walgreens and want to just be able to go into a drugstore and, you know, kind of get in and get out without having to call an attendant to get out a bottle of toothpaste. And so I think, you know, Daniel Lurie kind of came in and said, you know, we're going to restore normalcy to the streets. We're going to fully fund the police department. We're going to restore safety to public transit. And, you know, with all of the candidates, the details of how exactly they're going to do that is a bit unclear. But I think that there was this perception that the way that the system is currently running, we're not going to see visible change. And so I think that really did propel sort of an outsider to this role. And I will also note as well that, you know, with Lurie, he kind of was projecting this really nice guy, sort of benevolent billionaire attitude. You know, with the Mayor Breed, obviously she was the incumbent. She had a track record, a lot of good, but also a lot of bad. The other candidates were a bit more niche. And, you know, Mark Farrell, who was another big candidate, had a lot of campaign finance scandals to his name. And so I think people wanted a fresh start. They wanted someone that was promising accountability, who was going to clean house. And I think Daniel Lurie was that candidate for them.
Well, and to your point, Mayor-elect Lurie already said public safety is going to be a number one priority for him as he begins his new term here. So thanks for that rundown. Let's now talk about the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. You know, in many ways, that's really where a lot of the power in the city is. The mayor's office is, I think, relatively weak. I think a lot of observers would probably agree with that. And there were six seats on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors that were up for grabs this time around, including three current supervisors who are running for re-election. Now, several of these races were very close and haven't yet been called, but I'm going to just announce now what we know so far on these six seats. So I'll start with District 1, which is the Richmond District and Seacliff. Connie Chan, the progressive incumbent, has a slight lead over Marjan Filhauer, who's a moderate. And the Chronicle has called, the San Francisco Chronicle, your paper, has called the win for Chan this afternoon. And then there's District 3, which is Chinatown, North Beach, Fisherman's Wharf, Telegraph Hill, Nob Hill, Russian Hill, Financial District. There we have Danny Souter, who has won Aaron Peskin's seat over Peskin's preferred candidate, the moderate Sharon Lai. Then there's District 5, which is Tenderloin, Haight-Ashbury, Western Addition. Bilal Mahmoud, a moderate, currently leads Dean Preston, the progressive incumbent, by less than 2,000 votes. But Preston has conceded in an Instagram post yesterday saying, quote, "I wouldn't change a minute of it. We can't win every battle, but we'll continue the fight." So Preston has conceded and is out. District 7, then, is the Inner Sunset and Ingleside. Myrna Melgar, the incumbent, who's viewed as a progressive, sometimes sides with the moderate, has a slight lead over Matt Boschetto, who's a moderate, but that has not been called yet. Then there's District 9, which is the Mission, Bernal Heights, Portola, Jackie Fielder, the progressive, has won that seat to succeed Hillary Ronan, who's termed out. And then finally, there's District 11, which is the Excelsior, Outer Mission, Crocker, Amazon, Ingleside. And there you have Cheyenne Chen, who's a progressive, leading Michael Lai, the moderate, but it has not been called yet. So those are the latest there. And it seems like, you know, the current 7-4 progressive majority on the Board of Supervisors is now going to switch to a 6-5 moderate majority. But at the same time, moderate candidates will have lost more seats than they won in this round, winning only two of the six races. So it's a little head spinning, but I guess the question for you is, is this a win for moderates or a loss?
Yeah, no, head spinning is a great word. It's a lot to keep track of. I do think that overall, this is a win for the moderates. I mean, to sort of flip the balance of power on the board, I think is something that they've been vying to do for, you know, close to half a decade, if not longer. And so a lot of observers are seeing this as something of a political gift for Daniel Lurie, because, you know, one of the criticisms that Mayor Breed had of San Francisco governance was that a lot of her policies were kind of stymied by the Board of Supervisors that was often leaning more progressive than she was. And she had to, you know, work around them or would see some of her efforts sort of hitting impasses with them. So I think that this will be a positive thing for Lurie in terms of enacting his agenda, because he also does tend to lean more moderate. And I just want to note there's also another change coming to the board, because current District 2 Supervisor Catherine Stephanie was actually just elected to the California State Assembly. And so one of the last things that Mayor Breed will get to do in her term is appoint someone to replace Stephanie on the board. And Stephanie is, by many counts, the most moderate member of the Board of Supervisors. And I think, you know, the mayor will kind of follow suit and appoint a moderate to replace her. Although, you know, some have speculated, well, what if she wants to, you know, leave something for Lurie that won't be too great for him? But I don't think that she's going to do that. And so I think that's going to be another change coming to the board. But what's really fascinating for me is we're heading into kind of uncharted territory here with majority new Board of Supervisors, new mayor. The city has an $800 million deficit. There's also the specter of the Trump presidency. And so the decisions that they're going to make, I think, are going to be really, really interesting to watch, because they're definitely being thrown into the deep end from day one.
Well, to that point, our frequent guest and occasional guest host, Joe Eskenazi, tweeted out, to your point, the board is losing seasoned legislators, specifically Peskin and Preston, just at this moment of these headwinds in the federal government and the budget deficit. Just want to let listeners know, this is State of the Bay. You're listening to local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing local election results with Emily Hoven, opinion columnist and editorial writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, and we would love to hear from you. What issues were on your mind when you voted last week? Are you more optimistic now about San Francisco's future under a new mayor and a board of supervisors with several new members? And we also want to hear from our Oakland listeners, Oakland voters. What issues do you hope a new mayor will prioritize there? You can give us a call. The phone lines are open. We are at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We have an email in from Charlie in San Francisco who writes, "We need to get rid of ranked choice voting. Dean Preston got the most number one votes. There should have been a runoff. These results don't actually reflect what people want." So, Emily, what's your response to ranked choice voting? Was that a big factor here, or do you think there were other factors at play?
Yeah. There's ranked choice, I think, can play a significant role in some races. I mean, it's really interesting because, for example, even in the mayor's race, Daniel Lurie got the most first place ranked choice votes, which was very unexpected because most people had thought he would get the most second place votes and because of that, win the mayorship. But that didn't turn out to happen. I do think that in regard to the supervisor races, I believe the only race from what I have seen so far where a candidate got more votes in the last ranked choice voting round than the first is District 5, the one that Bilal Mahmood won. So that is a bit of an interesting outcome. You know, with it, there's pros and cons, right? And I think what we have seen that's been really interesting is even in San Francisco, you have elections where someone has won through ranked choice, and then it appears that that is not actually what the voters want. For example, the district attorney, the former district attorney, Chesa Boudin, won through ranked choice, and then, you know, actually ultimately had less than a majority of first place votes. He was recalled several years later. And in Oakland, we're seeing somewhat of a similar phenomenon where the current mayor, Sheng Tao, won through ranked choice, barely, and then, you know, was recalled by more than a majority of voters. So it can lead to kind of strange outcomes that don't necessarily seem to reflect the will of the majority. But, you know, its supporters say that it does lead to more equitable outcomes and it avoids costly runoff elections.
We have another email in from Sharon in San Francisco, picking up on your point about the opportunity for Mayor Breed to appoint a new supervisors. Do you have any thoughts about who she might appoint? Any intel there that you could share?
I don't have any special intel. I mean, I can just tell you that from what I'm hearing, there are a lot of folks that are kind of positioning themselves in line with her ear to kind of, you know, sway her opinion. I think it's also likely that outgoing Supervisor Stephanie will have somewhat of a significant say in who the mayor appoints. I think the mayor and the supervisor are somewhat close of allies, and I think, you know, she will have some sway over who the mayor ultimately does decide to choose for that seat.
And Emily, with so much turnover in San Francisco's leadership, what changes do you think San Francisco residents might see now? What do you think are going to be the emergent issues that are going to be really critical for these new leaders to address?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's largely the same issues that we've kind of been grappling with for a long time. I mean, I kind of sound like a broken record, but I think that, you know, crime, homelessness, just cost of living are huge issues for voters in San Francisco and also across the country. And I think that those are things that politicians here have been promising to address for years. Not much noticeable progress has been made on those. And so I think that it is really going to be incumbent on these newly elected officials who, you know, promised to be able to do something different than what the current group of people are in power are doing. They'll have to, you know, live up to those campaign promises. And then I think on top of that, you are going to potentially see some challenges with the new federal administration. You know, there have been some aggressive promises that President-elect Trump has made in regard to immigration, you know, deportation, and also even the allocation of federal funding. And so I think that if he does follow through on those threats, that is going to pose new challenges for the new officials that the current group did not really have to deal with in the same way, having a Democrat in the White House. So I think it's going to be a lot of the same things. Can we actually, you know, build more housing, bring down the cost of living for people in one of the most expensive regions of the state? You know, can we measurably bring down crime in a way where people no longer perceive crime to be an issue? And can we also address homelessness and drug use and see a significant decline in fatal overdoses and, you know, more people getting moved into shelter, more people, like entering treatment facilities as well. So I think that those are really going to be the things that voters are going to focus on. And then one last thing too, I'm thinking of now is education. The San Francisco School District is in a lot of turmoil. There's a new superintendent. They are running out of money. They were going to close schools. Now they're not going to close schools. And so I think turning things around in SFUSD and kind of giving confidence to parents and families that their kids will get a good public school education here is going to be really, really critical for the newly elected people.
Well, on that point, Emily, any thoughts about the school board election coming up?
Yeah, so it's interesting with that. We've had a couple of new folks who are sort of perceived as more, you know, moderate, friendly, parent advocate people sworn in, or I should say elected. So we have Jamie Huling, Parag Gupta, and Supriya Ray, all of whom kind of were supported by parent groups that sprung up during the pandemic to oppose the way that the district was handling closures, you know, math education, renaming schools, et cetera. It's really interesting because there's one more seat that's up, and it's either going to go to incumbent board president Matt Alexander, who progressives have tended to align with, but who has kind of now changed his tune and is being a lot more result-oriented, or John Gerson, who ran on a slate with some of the other elected candidates. They are currently both tied at 12.1% of the vote. So I think, you know, depending on who wins there, the balance of the board could shift considerably.
Emily, let's go ahead and talk about some of the local ballot measures now in San Francisco. There were two key propositions on the ballot, propositions D and E, which focused on streamlining local government by reducing the number of commissions. Can you talk about what was at stake and how those propositions fared?
Yeah. So Prop D and E, as you said, were these competing measures to address San Francisco's problem of having a copious amount of commissions, advisory boards. No one even really seems to know how many boards there actually are. And there were some boards that were overseeing departments that no longer existed. So it was a huge mess. And, you know, the mayor and her allies were saying that these types of boards were basically impeding her ability to address key issues like crime and safety. And so Proposition D was put forward by a moderate group called Together SF that gets funding from a lot of sort of moderate billionaires in the city. They wanted to set a hard cap of 65 commissions and basically only keep those that were required by state or federal law. And then another group would be created to sort of decide which of the remaining commissions should be allowed to be added on, but it could not pass 65. And it would also have given the mayor more control over the people who are appointed to those boards, and it would have given the mayor sole authority to hire and fire the heads of departments. Again, which they said was necessary to kind of ensure that the mayor can actually enact their vision for the city. And then Prop E was put forward by Board of Supervisors President Aaron Peskin, who decried Prop D as being written in back rooms by billionaires and, you know, setting this arbitrary cap. And Prop E basically creates a commission to study commissions and, you know, allows for more public input as to which commissions should be kept and which might, you know, maybe should be eliminated. But it doesn't really set any formal guidelines as to whether any need to be cut at all or, you know, what they should look like. And it would keep the current balance of power in regard to the board can appoint some commissioners, the mayor can appoint some, and it keeps the current structure in regard to department head hiring and firing. And so what is ironic is that Prop E was put on there in reaction to Prop D. Prop D failed, and Prop E looks like it is on track to pass. So that's kind of been an interesting outcome because there was so much money funneled in support of Prop D and not that much in support of Prop E, but voters chose the latter.
And I'll also just point out Prop K, which would close the Great Highway to Cars, passed with a pretty stark divide there. The election map showed that Western precincts largely voted against it, and all the Eastern precincts seemed to favor it. But we'll have to leave that for another show. I just want to let listeners know this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkheim, and we're discussing local election results with Emily Hoven, opinion columnist, editorial writer, with the San Francisco Chronicle, and we'd love to hear from you. We're going to talk about Oakland in a second. So Oakland voters, what issues are you hoping that a new mayor is going to prioritize? You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And one more question on San Francisco from a listener. Wendy in San Francisco asks, I'm wondering how the guest sees the electorate changing in San Francisco, the general shift to the center. Does she think this shift will continue? So Emily, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that shift will, which is marked, by the way. I mean, basically San Francisco, more people voted for Trump this election cycle than they did in prior years, even though they had a hometown candidate on the ballot, which is very startling to see. I think the shift towards the center will continue if the moderate candidates that were recently elected can actually make a measurable difference on the issues that voters care about. If they don't, I think we might ironically see a swing back to the left because I think if there's no progress made, voters tend to sort of demonstrate this sort of knee-jerk anti-incumbent sentiment because they feel, oh, the people in power are not doing anything to actually help me. So if that is true and the moderates are not any more successful at addressing these issues than the progressives were, I think we might go back to the left. But I think that if the moderates are able to make demonstrable change, I think people will continue to support centrist candidates.
All right, well, let's turn to the East Bay. A lot of action over there. There were two recalls on the ballot in the city of Oakland. Mayor Sheng Tao and Alameda County District Attorney Pamela Price both were elected in 2022 on progressive platforms, and now both have been recalled. The mayor recall campaign, the campaign to recall the mayor, is largely funded by a Piedmont hedge fund executive. Kind of a controversial issue here, but pretty decisive. Over 65% or 64% voted to recall Mayor Tao, 65% voted to recall District Attorney Price. What do you make of those recall campaigns? Why were they successful?
Yeah, I think kind of, again, this idea of money influencing elections, there's no doubt that money does influence elections, but I think also if the other side cannot come up with a compelling message, then that's largely on them. And I think for the mayor and for the district attorney to say only, well, this is an anti-democratic effort that was funded by a billionaire, that is not really going to be a successful message if you can't also point to the fact that, you know, you have measurably improved residents' lives and done your job effectively. And I think what we saw with this recall, I mean, the margins were not even close. Voters clearly do not think that Mayor Tao and District Attorney Pamela Price were doing their jobs effectively. You know, over and over again, I was hearing from folks that they just, again, want to feel safe. They don't want to have illegal dumping going on. They don't want to drive past, you know, blocks long homeless encampments. With the DA, they wanted to feel that victims were being prioritized. You know, a lot of people made the comment to me that, you know, offenders have public defenders. You know, it's not the job of the prosecutor to, you know, support the offender over the victim. And people just wanted to feel that they were getting justice. And I don't think that they felt that. And clearly, I think it was especially egregious in the case of the district attorney. She missed the statute of limitations to review more than 1,000 misdemeanor cases, which is just the most baseline aspect of her job that I think it really astonished voters to realize that she's not even, regardless of policy, she's not even completing just basic elements of her job. And so I think people, again, they're tired of rhetoric and they just want to see results. They want to see results.
And I have to ask, as we wrap up this segment, because we're just about out of time, but the national context here, you wrote in a recent opinion piece that California Governor Newsom is now in a position to be the next leader in the Democratic Party. Should California residents be happy about that? Should we be concerned about how it might influence his priorities here? What's the broader take with Trump being reelected now and Newsom as a potential leader for the Democrats?
Yeah, I think there's always a concern when you have local politicians aiming for higher office and allowing that to color everything that they do rather than focusing on the issues that they were elected to actually address. And, you know, with the governor, that's been a bit of a longstanding issue where his national ambitions have affected the way that he handles policies in California. I think, you know, there is an opportunity in this, which is if he does want to be a leader of the Democratic Party and he does want to position California as sort of this beacon of hope in a dark nation, then he needs to actually deliver on those things for Californians. For me, it is just shocking that, you know, California has been losing residents to states like Texas and Florida, actually giving red states more power in the House of Representatives because of the fact that people are leaving because they can't afford to live here and because of crime and homelessness. And I think that for the governor to be successful in any future endeavor, he needs to address cost of living, public safety, and just, again, this concept of government competency. So I hope that he sort of takes the national election as an opportunity to deliver on those things for Californians.
Well, no question. A lot of challenges locally, statewide, and nationally. But really appreciate you joining us to explain what happened last week, not just on that national stage, but right here in the Bay Area. Emily Hoven, opinion columnist and editorial writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ethan.
And coming up after the break, we're going to hear from Ray Black of For the Win Gym, which supports women and non-binary people in growing their skills as boxers. We'll be right back.
On the next Your Calls One Planet series, we'll discuss what the election means for the environment and frontline communities. Donald Trump promises to accelerate domestic fossil fuel production, withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, and gut President Biden's environmental laws. In order to prevent an even worse climate catastrophe, we must reduce emissions by 50% by 2030. Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
That will be a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call, and that takes place this evening at 7. On KALW 91.7 FM.
Way back in 1972, Title IX passed, which in its many iterations has advocated for equal funding and support for women and girls in athletics. We've come a long way. but there are still some corners of the gym where it's rare to see women and non-binary people in a serious athletic pursuit. One of those areas is boxing. I'm Fred Pitts. This is State of the Bay. And our guest tonight is Ray Black. Ray is the founder and owner of For the Win Boxing, a private boxing gym in Oakland that supports women plus and non-binary people pursuing boxing. Ray Black, welcome to State of the Bay.
How's it going?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. How did you get involved in boxing?
Well, it's something I've always wanted to do. I was unfortunately deterred from it as a young person because my mom didn't believe that females should participate in boxing. Mm-hmm. And so despite having access to a heavy bag at home, I wasn't allowed to enter a gym and participate. I did continue to do quite a few other sports fairly competitively. So I was able to be athletic, just not in an area that I was really drawn to at a young age.
Oh, you mentioned the heavy bag. Does somebody else in the family box?
I just asked my dad at his house if I could get a heavy bag, and he was like, sure. So he hung it up in the garage, and I would kind of go ham on it.
That's kind of cool. Did you get to box with other people your age when you were younger?
More like getting into sparring matches with my brother and his friends and some of my male friends, but less actually taking any directive with it.
Okay. And I know that you said you liked other sports. So what other sports did you do that weren't boxing at the time?
I played soccer for 25 years. Hardball for 9 years. I was the first girl in the league, the only girl in Petaluma. And I played travel basketball, and I was the only girl in the league. Pretty much any sport I was really into and tried it out. But soccer, rugby, baseball.
Wow. And you still do those? Did you give them up to pursue boxing?
I quit soccer because of injury. Unfortunately, yeah. Goalkeeping is hard on your body.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So I switched over to boxing.
Okay. When did you start boxing a lot?
2012.
Okay. Excellent. And you started For the Win in, what was it, 2023? Is that correct? You wanted to make a positive environment for underrepresented people in boxing, and it provides classes and coaching to serious athletes. Tell us something about the clients that you coach.
Sure. I have a wide range of folks. Some want to do boxing in master's division, which is 35 and older. Some mm-hmm. want to compete on a more competitive level, which I train those folks. And I also just have people who want to use boxing as a modality of fitness, feel more empowered, self-defense, get in their body, and they just mm-hmm. enjoy it. And they've always been curious about it.
Now, women have made a lot of progress in athletics since Title IX in the 70s, of course, but women's boxing didn't appear in the Olympics until 2012. So what happened?
I'm not actually sure, but it did. And Clarissa Shields, the GOAT, was able to bring home a gold. And then she went back in 2016 and brought home another gold.
Yes, she did.
And since then, we've been in the Olympics, which is only two more times since 2016, but with Clarissa Shields being as dominant as she was, and with the IQ that she has and mm-hmm. the skill set that she possesses, we've been able to switch up a narrative, at least in the United States, about boxing for women. Mm-hmm. Internationally, I think women are given a little bit more opportunity on an amateur level. And we mm-hmm. see that with like China or Taiwan. They have actual schools that young prospects.
Interesting. I've also read historically that at least with women in boxing, for a lot of promoters, it was more about spectacle than anything else.
Correct. Yeah. Sideshow.
Sideshow. Okay. Yeah. How long did that go on? For years, I guess?
Yeah, I think since the 70s. I can't remember her name, but there were a couple, aside from Christy Martin, who was mm-hmm. one of the first famous, and then Layla Ali came after that. Right. Sia Riker. But prior to that, there were only a couple of gals who were able to get on shows, and they were usually pretty aggressive style, less technique oriented. Not saying they didn't have any technique by any means, mm-hmm. but yeah. As we've evolved into the GOAT era, we get to see the skill set really shine.
Mm-hmm. What do you think boxing can do for the groups that you are specifically trying to reach?
Oh, I think the level of empowerment you get is unmatched. I've played a lot of other sports and been mm-hmm. male-dominated spaces, and thankfully I'm very athletic, so I get to things. But when gals are told their whole lives that in order to box, you have to look a certain way or act a certain way or be a man, or that it's inherently violent, it deters a lot of gals. So they don't end up getting in their bodies overall in the same way that men are hoarded. And that includes other sports, but specifically with boxing. So I think that once a gal realizes, or an AFAB assigned female at birth realizes that they can throw a punch and that it feels good and it's not scary, they kind of get a fire inside them and they become confident in a way that they didn't realize they were before. And I think it just provides agency.
Okay. Well, that's what you love to provide people, just to give them the power to understand that they can do anything and there are no restrictions. And that's one of the challenges I know with sports. And I remember this summer, the whole controversy started with IBA, a couple of boxes with the Olympics. And can you tell us a little bit more what happened there?
Are we talking about the IBA controversy in the 2016 Olympics? Or the 2024 Olympics?
Both. Where it started, and then the message came out this summer,
Yeah, so the IBA is really corrupt. And
we know
they,
that.
Yeah, they are
for people part who of don't the, know that they are.
They are. They are very corrupt, and they are the reason why 2028 may not have boxing. Quite a few judges, most of the judges were in on fixing matches, and a lot of winners lost. I think this fighter in the UK, Michael Conlan, pushed forth a lot of narrative about it being corrupt, and then it came into light that it was. And then moving into the 2024 Olympics, the IBA are the ones that claim to have tested two female boxers, Iman Khalif and Lin Yuting, and claimed that they were either XY chromosome or that they had elevated levels of testosterone. They remained really ambiguous, I think intentionally, and none of which are true. So
that's why I figured. And I think they were both banned by the IBA in the 2023 World Boxing Championships.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. As I was reading, I whenever they're questioned about the tests that they run, they say nothing.
They say nothing because they didn't run a test.
It's this mysterious test that just happened to disappear, kind of like Jimmy Hoffa.
Yes.
So this is how it goes. And you talked before about the first punch being a big deal for people.
Yeah.
And when that happened, I mean, you're a boxer. What are the strategies used in boxing? I mean, boxing is not just about hitting people. It's an art form. I mean, I grew up watching it as a kid. I think it's an art form. There's so much you can learn from boxing that I'd love you to educate people out there about.
Yeah, well, it's called the sweet science for a reason. The idea is to hit, not get hit. I prefer my boxers learn sound defense as well as an offense, but not relying on your offense as your primary modality of defense. That leads to preservation of your overall health, but also you can create openings to score points, dominate matches. You can make your opponents feel like they shouldn't be in the ring with you if they're constantly missing against you, which is always fun to watch. Whether Andre Ward, both were brilliant tacticians in their day. Yep.
Very true. I think I read someplace that you thought that boxing is kind of like meditation in a way.
Yeah, definitely. Like,
how so?
I think that with all sport, both boxing specifically, because you have to constantly be in your body in a way that other sports don't command. So the more that it flows out of you, the less force it comes, the more in the zone you are. And when you're in the zone, you look like Pernell Whitaker or Clarissa Shields, because I'm going to keep bringing her up. She's the boat. But when you're in the zone, you have this free-flowing state where you can pull off movements and it's not forced and you're able to flip a punch and roll and counter without having to pause or take time away from your overall, your game plan of the fight. And I think there's such a fluidity, and it's chess with a little bit of contact, or a lot of contact, rather.
That's what I was thinking. It was just listening to you talking about this. We could go on for hours, but we're probably going to have to wrap it up here. But it's been great hearing about all the glass ceilings that you and your boxers are completely smashing through. If anyone out there wants to learn more about coaching and competitive boxing, you can go look up Ray's boxing site at www.ftwboxing.com. Ray, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I am Fred Pitts. That was Ray Black, owner of For the Win Boxing, and this is State of the Bay.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 to hear from the author of a book about the art and science of listening. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our page on KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Mooney and Heather Hughes, engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. A rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call is coming up next. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.